Radio Times, I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moscowane. To paraphrase a recent New York Times blog, primary care in this country is hurtling toward a crisis point. Relatively few medical students are choosing to become primary care physicians. Many rural and urban areas are struggling with primary care shortages, and those shortages could only grow worse. Experts are predicting the need for an additional 52,000 general practitioners over the next 10 years as boomers age and more Americans become insured under the Affordable Care Act. Here to help us sort it all out are Richard Barron, President and CEO of the American Board of Internal Medicine. He's practiced internal medicine and geriatrics for over 30 years. Welcome to Radio Times.
It's good to be here. Good morning, Mary.
Good morning. Anne O'Sullivan is Professor of Primary Care Nursing at the University of Pennsylvania School of Nursing. She's a practicing pediatric nurse practitioner. Glad to have you here, Anne.
Good morning, Mary.
And Julie Rovner is Senior Correspondent for Kaiser Health News and the Robin Toner Distinguished Fellow. A familiar voice, Rovner was formerly Health Policy Correspondent for NPR, and she joins us from Washington. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Mary.
So, Richard Barron, is that your perspective, that we are hurtling toward a crisis point in primary care medicine?
I think we are, because of the factors that you mentioned, that we have expanded coverage in the country through the Affordable Care Act, and we are going to see increased demands with an aging population and more of them. But I think that we recognize that and have a number of potential policy solutions. And broadly, the policy solutions are on both sides. We need a different model of care, and we need a different model of payment. And maybe later in the program, we'll talk about how those things are coming into being. So I think there are emerging policy responses, but the forces are pretty dramatic. And I think that we need to move forward quickly with those policy responses.
Let's look at how an office is typically constructed today. You have the primary care physician, but also, if you're talking about the primary care model, you also have nurse practitioners.
Absolutely.
Physician assistants.
Absolutely.
And how does that team work together to provide primary care?
Well, I think that is part of our challenge, is building the right care model where that team does work together. One of the characteristics of the way practice is organized today, in whether it's nurse practitioner practice or primary care practice, a lot of it is visit-based. And it's visit-based because the way the payment system works, that's what doctors get paid for doing. And at a time when patients would like to get medical advice by email, when patients would like to get ask questions on the phone, when there are all kinds of ways that people could be interacting, we still have a model that is visit-based, and we need to move to a team-based model.
And Mary, I've practiced for 35 years, and nurse practitioners can do 95% of the primary care issues that walk into a primary care office, particularly here in the Philadelphia area. And I think one of the things that we're in hopes will happen over time so that we'd have new models is that we would all get full practice authority. So often in my own practice, you know, I can see a family, I can do fill out all their forms, but I can't sign a durable medical equipment form to get them diapers. I can give them all the prescriptions in the world, but I have to go to my physician colleague because in Pennsylvania, I don't have full practice authority. So I think with new models that we'll be able to be more successful and be able to manage some of this demand with regards to primary care, because we do, in the nurse practitioner industry, put out 14 or 15,000 nurse practitioners every single year.
So full practice authority, meaning no physician overseeing the office.
That's correct.
And Richard Barron, your thoughts on that?
I think anywhere in healthcare, people should be practicing at the top of their license. People should be using their full skills. I think one of the things we get wrong in primary care is we have the wrong people doing the work. We have doctors doing a lot of clerical work that they shouldn't be doing. Nurse practitioners, as Anne just said, are filling out forms that maybe they shouldn't be filling out, whether they have licensing authority or not. So I think the big problem to solve is how we distribute work among people who have the skills to do it. And a lot of work that falls to primary care is work that people who are way overqualified to do that work are doing. Team-based care would create a continuity spectrum that some of what patients need, they should be talking to a clerical person. Some of what patients need, they could be talking to a health educator. Some of what patients need, they should be dealing with a nurse practitioner. Some of what patients need, they should be dealing with a physician. getting that right is a big part of our challenge in primary care.
So quick question before we bring Julie Robner into the conversation. If you had full practice authority, would this help to ease some of the shortage crisis in rural and urban areas?
I believe it would, due to the fact in Pennsylvania alone, in the Northwest area, because we don't have full practice authority, a nurse practitioner has to have two physicians agree to be their collaborating physician in order to prescribe. If we had full practice authority, that would not be a problem. We had, I think it was Oil City in Pennsylvania, where in fact a nurse was going to lose her collaborating physicians, and those 3,000 patients were going to have no provider in that area within a 25-mile radius until she could find two new collaborating physicians, which was very hard to do in that particular area of the country in Pennsylvania. So I think full practice authority would not have been a problem for her. She would have been able to maintain that practice load without any issues.
Julie Robner, let's get to the Affordable Care Act. Tell us, if you would, how that has exacerbated, if it has, the primary care shortage?
Well, the people who wrote the Affordable Care Act recognized, obviously, the two things that you talked about at the top, which is that you have 10,000 baby boomers a day getting onto Medicare, needing health care, and that the Affordable Care Act itself was going to expand people who had insurance and therefore likely would be looking for care, particularly primary care. So there's an entire section of the Affordable Care Act devoted to primary care training. Now, part of the problem is that not all of that has been funded. In fact, about half of the programs that were in that section of the law have been funded and half haven't. But there was indeed a lot of thought given to things that were already emerging, like team care, like using non-physicians to provide primary care. And some of that is starting to filter its way through the system, things like the Teaching Health Centers program, where medical students and residents are actually trained within community health centers, places were in by definition underserved areas.
So what might happen with funding after November in the elections?
Oh, no, I don't think anybody's thinking that there's going to be more funding for the Affordable Care Act. That would be, you know, a huge uphill fight no matter what. So then the question is whether, you know, funding gets moved around, at what point, you know, Congress starts to pay attention to this. Congress hasn't been paying attention to very much sort of health-related other than having sort of, you know, big headline-level fights about, you know, sort of show votes to repeal or not repeal the law, but actually digging into the law, figuring out how to, you know, now that we're 4 years in, how to make it work better, that hasn't really been on anybody's agenda.
So the law, you feel, will remain intact for the time being?
Well, it's certainly not going to get repealed while President Obama's in office.
Right. Okay. Let's talk about medical students choosing primary care. Physicians are obviously a critical component of the primary care model, and according to the Council on Graduate Medical Education, fewer than 20% of med students end up in primary care, although half indicate an interest in primary care on their first day of medical school. So what happens, Richard Barron, between that first day and graduation?
A lot of things happen. The healthcare system much more generously supports specialty care than it does primary care. And that's not just about the income of providers. That's about the resources they have to do their job. So if you're practicing as an orthopedic surgeon or you're practicing as an interventional cardiologist, there are a bunch of investments that the health system is making that make it possible for you to do your job in a really good way. There are not similar investments in primary care right now. And as a result, the practice winds up being mired in some of the administrative details. Surgeons don't sterilize their own instruments. Surgeons have a bunch of people in the operating room to help them do what they do. And they don't go to work in the morning and say, well, we're only going to use sterile instruments if the tech who runs the autoclave showed up for work today. If she didn't, we'll go ahead and use yesterday's tray again. That's not the model under which we use surgical practice. But primary care people, and the medical students see it, are often scrambling. They're being asked to do a lot of things that are things that clinically trained people shouldn't be doing. It creates some inefficiency. It creates some frustration. And we need to move toward, as I was saying earlier, a team-based model, and we need to move toward a payment system that recognizes the value that primary care contributes, which is not primarily at visits anymore, especially with information technology, population health possibilities, proactive care, all sorts of ways to manage and track patients over time rather than waiting for them to get sick and show up.
Primary care doctors make less money than specialists. That's a disincentive.
It is a disincentive.
Anne's nodding her head.
There's no question that it's a disincentive. And frankly, one of the, even with respect to nurse practitioners, primary care colleagues who are trying to recruit nurse practitioners find that the orthopedic practices are paying higher salaries for the same person, or the GI practice is paying a higher salary for the same person. So the same forces that are working on physician choice of primary care also work on nursing choices in primary care, and similarly for physicians' assistants, the same forces are out there. So the economic forces, I think, are pretty important in driving some of those choices.
If you had to characterize the importance of primary care to the average citizen's health, how would you do that?
I think it's
in comparison to other specialties.
Well, of course, it depends on the situation you find yourself in. If you have a fever of 104 and severe pain in the right side of your belly and you're having a gallbladder attack, a surgeon is the most important person to you that you're going to need to see.
Sure.
But over time, primary care people are the front door of the healthcare system. They're when patients have a problem that they don't know what it is, they're not sure what it is, or they're trying to maintain their health or optimize their health, or they're facing choices among a bunch of different options for procedures they might have or treatments they might have. Primary care people help bridge a lot of gaps that the existing healthcare system has. And I think those relationships are foundational to people getting the most out of healthcare.
And
I think Richard's correct in that some nurse practitioners go into the orthopedic and specialty practices, but about 85% of the primary care prepared nurse practitioners stay in the primary care arena. And so that's incredibly important to be of making more primary care providers available. I think the group of population that I'm most worried about with the Affordable Care Act and Medicaid expansion, particularly in Pennsylvania, is the poor non-elderly, so that we have about 500,000 more Medicaid patients that could be coming into primary care, and we won't have the providers if we don't have nurse practitioners with full practice authority to help do the delivery of the primary care for these people.
Julie Robner, how does the Affordable Care address this issue?
Well, as I mentioned, there are a number of programs aimed at encouraging the training of primary care practitioners, physicians, nurse practitioners, physician assistants. Actually, I have some statistics from the Graham Center, which looks at these things. It says that only just over half of nurse practitioners are actually in primary care right now, and less than half of physician assistants are in primary care right now. And again, as we talked about, that can be mostly financial. They can earn more money doing other things. So that is a big issue. There are not big financing changes to how doctors and other healthcare practitioners get paid in the Affordable Care Act. That's clearly going to be something people are going to have to look at as they go forward.
All right, we're going to have to take a break. Our number to call is 888-477-9499. If you'd like to join the conversation, I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moskowain.
The Dow Chemical Company supports WHYY. Dow combines the power of science and technology to help address many of the world's most challenging problems. Together, the elements of science and the human element can solve anything. Learn more at Dow.com.
If you are at least 20 pounds overweight, you may be eligible to participate in Project Impact, a research study at Drexel University. This weight loss program is designed to help adult men and women lose weight and keep it off without medication. Guidance from weight loss specialists at group meetings is included. Project Impact is funded by the National Institutes of Health. More information online at drexel.edu/weightloss or 215-553-7110. Drexel University supports WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Paige Rawl was born with HIV. She's now become an activist on living with the disease and ending the kind of bullying she got from classmates.
I was having stress-induced seizures. I lost about 20 pounds. My hair began to fall out. I also was catatonic.
From bullying. That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY. The Philadelphia Inquirer supports WHYY and offers the Live Life Love section, a new arts and entertainment section in the Sunday Inquirer, which includes upcoming concerts and events, fashion, coupons, restaurant reviews, and more. Details at inquirer.com/haveyouseenit.
I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in today for Marty Moscowane. The subject this hour is primary care in this country hurtling toward a crisis point. Our guests are Julie Rovner, senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Anne O'Sullivan is professor of primary care nursing at the University of Pennsylvania School of Nursing. And Richard Barron is president and CEO of the American Board of Internal Medicine. And as always, we welcome your input. You can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email at radiotimes@whyy.org or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And if you happen to be a medical student, what do you think of a future in primary care? We'd love to know. Anyway, Julie, to you, let's get back to the Affordable Care Act. My understanding in chatting with Richard and Anne is that there is increased payment for primary care under the ACA?
Well, there is it's a two-year program for all primary care services provided through Medicaid. One of the problems is that that program is going to expire, and it's not clear what's going to happen after that. There is some thought that some states may pick up and continue those increased payments. But that was, a short-term boost for, and it was not just primary care, doctors who are getting this payment. It was everybody who's providing primary care services.
All right. What are the disincentives to practicing in a rural or a poor urban area, and conversely, the incentives? Because this is where you find as they were talking about, healthcare deserts. I've seen that phrase. Richard?
The challenge is that the patients who live there have ripple over and spill over into the health care that they need. So socioeconomic disadvantage is a cross-cutting disadvantage and a major factor in health status. People who have trouble accessing the health care system because they don't have insurance, that's one set of issues. People who may have insurance, who may have payment for health care related services, may not have transportation coverage, may not have a bunch of the infrastructure things that you need. Trying to provide primary care to a homeless population, trying to provide primary care to a population that has major dual diagnosis in the behavioral health side, whether it's chemical dependency, whether it's chronic mental illness, those become cross-cutting challenges in patients taking care of their diabetes or taking care of their blood pressure. So lots of the things about being poor or being in a rural area where you're far from services ripple when you're trying to do what you think of as ordinary health care as a provider, and it's one of the things that providers find deeply frustrating.
And it's also not necessarily something, if you're way out, away from the city, away from the theater, away from things that you like, an incentive for, say, a young person to take his or her practice and go out to a rural area.
Well,
which is where it's badly needed.
Surely. And I think the biggest reason anybody's done that in the past is, and we often saw it with physicians who've finished a primary care residency, go out to that rural area for 2 or 3 years because they get their tuition reduced, mm-hmm. that payment mechanism. But then because they've had such a difficult time and they didn't choose to go there initially, they burn out and they either go into a specialty or they come back into the city. In Pennsylvania alone, in the non-rural area, we have one provider for every 382 people. Mm. But in the rural area, we have one provider for every 663 people. Mm-hmm. And so a colleague of mine at the university did a research study very recently with regards to practices taking Medicaid patients. And only one in three of the primary care practices, even in the rural areas, are taking any Medicaid patients. So again, that poor, non-elderly patient really is going to suffer the most with regards to being in a rural area.
That program that Anne just described, that would actually be me. I financed my medical education by mm-hmm. signing up for a program called the National Health Service Corps, and in response owed a year of government service for each year that they supported in medical school. And I went from Midtown Manhattan on Toid to Southeast Tennessee, mm-hmm. Where my wife and I were the only New Yorkers for many miles around. It was a spectacular clinical experience, being the only doctor in the western half of a county. It actually taught me a lot about accountability of practice people to the community and was very influential in the shape of my career.
But
it was a hard place to stay. Sure. It was a hard place to raise a family, having come from New York City. And ultimately, we chose to come back to the Northeast to be closer to family. And I think that the track record of the National Health Service Corps, some of those folks stay, but a lot of them don't. Mm-hmm. And one of the another thing that has happened at the federal level, I think, is efforts to expand support for the National Health Service Corps, both because it gets more of all kinds of healthcare providers out to rural areas, and it gives the hope is that some of them will be able to stay, even though, as I say, I was not.
Let's talk about Medicaid reimbursement. There was an interesting study in JAMA Internal Medicine, which used researchers posing as new patients who called about 8,000 primary care practices in 10 states. So 85% of those who posed as patients with private insurance were able to get in pretty quickly. Only 58% of those posing as patients with Medicaid were able to do so. So what's the sticking point? Doctors are not getting the money that they feel they deserve for Medicaid, not getting it quickly?
Both those things. Mm-hmm. Medicaid tends to pay less than other payers, and it tends to be harder to get money from Medicaid agencies because the billing processes don't run as smoothly. And to some extent, clinicians feel that when they're taking on this population, they're taking on the kinds of challenges that I was describing earlier. Mm-hmm. So they feel like they're working harder with the patients and not being as rewarded as well. That said, I think that many physicians, that 58% of people could get in, is a testimony to the professionalism of clinical providers who are basically agreeing to do more work for less pay. And they're saying that more than they're not saying that. Now, they're not saying it as much as they are on the commercial side. That's true. And I think incentives matter. But I think it's worth pointing out that it is very clear that it is not a good business decision
Sure.
to be functioning in the Medicaid system if you could be functioning in the commercial system. And it's an example of the professionalism of healthcare providers everywhere that they do that.
And Julie Robner, does the Affordable Care Act address this at all?
Well, we mentioned earlier, so the increased payment. One of the things we haven't talked about with Medicaid is Medicaid managed care, mm-hmm. which of course does make it easier for patients in Medicaid to find clinicians because by definition they're in a network, and more and more states are putting people, this is particularly the under age 65, the non-disabled population, into managed care, which does ease access somewhat.
Okay, let's get to the telephones. Ed from Newark, Delaware, you're live on Radio Times. Welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning.
A few years ago, my very fine primary care doc retired, and he was very unhappy about the economics that you've mentioned, and he was even more unhappy that those economics put him in a position where his practice of 30 years was not an asset that he could resell. Thinking about how to find a primary care doc, I looked to the big hospital chain near where I live, which has some primary care docs who are its employees. So I'm seen in a facility and by support personnel that the hospital chain is responsible for, and this has been at least a way that I could have a primary care doc who's a graduate of an American medical school and in whom I have confidence.
Thank you, Ed, for the call to Radio Times. Richard Barron, you've heard this story before.
I sure have. And, Ed, I think you're talking about a national trend, and it's a national trend for a bunch of different forces. Whether doctors want to be or not, or nurses in states with independent authority want to be or not, if you practice independently, you're operating a small business in the United States of America. That's what you're doing. And you have to comply with EEOC hiring regulations, and you have to comply with local zoning regulations, and you have to manage HIPAA, and now you have to manage technology, and you have to figure out how to bill. And it has become a very complex enterprise. And a number of people coming out of medical school today, some people say the millennials are valuing work-life balance more than some of their older clinicians. And a lot of people are saying, you know, I don't think I want to run my own business. I think I want to try to focus on patient care. The other side of that is hospitals have recognized and health systems have recognized that there are values to integration, that information can move between providers more smoothly. So if you're seeing a gastroenterologist and a surgeon and a radiologist, if they're all using the same electronic health record and exchanging information among each other, that can lead to a smoother and better and safer patient experience. The challenge has been nationally that sometimes when people aggregate into those systems, they are then negotiating pretty aggressively with local insurers, and prices go up, not down. And so the federal government is trying to balance how much should we be encouraging that, because information moves better, care can be smoother, transitions can be safer. But economic actors behave as economic actors, and large healthcare providers are economic actors. So it's a real dilemma for policy people.
I think Ed brings up another point, interestingly enough, and that is that he was looking for someone who was U.S. trained. And we know that half of the primary care residents are not U.S. trained. And so I think he was very fortunate in being able to find someone U.S. trained in the area he describes he was looking.
Does it make a difference? Because they still have to pass their boards in this country, correct? If they are trained out
You do not need to pass boards to practice medicine in the United States. You need to be licensed. And passing boards deals with American training and passing a rigorous exam that's administered here in the States. So it is clearly an emblem of quality, but it is not required for practice in the United States.
All right. Whereas we know nurse practitioners, all of them across the country, they have the similar education, the schools have been accredited, they sit for a national board exam, and then they receive the license as an APRN, Advanced Practice Registered Nurse.
Let's get back to the ACA. Excuse me. Julie Robner, we've got a question from Steve. He's emailed us. How does the ACA address medical malpractice insurance, and does this affect the primary care shortage?
It doesn't, is the short answer. It pretty much doesn't. That was an issue that Congress just did not want to try and get into very much. There are a lot of people who are sort of bemoaning the fact that, that there's just not very much about malpractice in the Affordable Care Act. But I don't think, you know, I think what we've been talking about are really the big issues in primary care. I don't think malpractice is a particularly big issue about whether physicians and other health practitioners go into primary care. I think one thing we didn't talk about, although maybe a little bit, is demographics, is the idea of, you know, the vast majority of graduating, certainly physicians, are married now. Many of them, we have more than half are women, and it's very hard if you're going to take your spouse to, you know, sort of a remote place, then what's your spouse going to do for a living? So that's another thing that sort of militates against moving out to some of these underserved areas. It's a lot of things, but I don't think malpractice is a big piece of it.
All right. We've got this Facebook note from Jennifer. The shortage must be affecting the service. It seems like PCPs are triple booking appointments. We knew this was coming. Rushing you out the door and referring you to specialists for prescriptions. I think that's a universal sentiment. Is that fair to say?
Certainly, a stressed system will behave badly and will not provide the level of service that patients want and deserve. We were actually talking with a staff member here at HYY, whose husband, an ophthalmologist, is in the process of implementing an electronic health record. And she was talking about how he's staying at the office later and apologizing to patients routinely. Again, major federal incentive to get all doctors, but particularly primary care doctors, onto electronic health records. Having lived through that experience in my own practice, it was among the most challenging periods of my entire professional life. It's very stressful. All of your listeners, whatever kind of work they do, have lived through a system upgrade in their workplace or a change in a core technology system that they use. If they did it in a large company, they had a lot of technological support. They had a lot of educational support. They had training. What's happening in the United States right now is doctors across the country are leaping into electronic health records with minimal training, minimal technology support, and having a very hard time with it.
They are required to do so, are they not, Julie Robner?
Yes, generally. There are federal rules now about having electronic medical records. There are some. It varies the extent to which you have them. There's something called meaningful use. It's a whole other conversation. But generally, most practitioners are now moving over into having electronic medical records. But I think the speed with which particularly primary care physicians are rushing patients through has more to do with insurance reimbursement and probably less to do with some other things.
I think the triple booking also comes with if you live in a community and practice in a community where people are unable to keep their appointments in an effort to be able to see those people who really want to see you, you might double book appointments knowing full well that only 50% of the people who are booked actually come.
So is that common?
So that seems very common, certainly in the practice that I've been in for 35 years. And I think that when both parties come who have been double booked, you know, we make every effort to see them as quickly as we can. I think that it's very key that we need to have a collaboration between the community and ourselves so that we can manage this kind of the time and waiting. But I do want to tell everybody that if you hang on there long enough with this electronic medical records, that it gets much better and it helps all of us. It helps me as a provider and it helps my clients because one, they can come in with one family member and say, golly, could I have the immunization records of the other three children? And I'm able to find them a whole lot quicker than I would if I was pulling three charts off a wall.
And the triple booking is actually an example of where we have evidence about a better scheduling model that a number of practices are using, but not everybody, and that scheduling model is referred to as open access. The bottom line is that if you make an appointment 3 months from now, first of all, there's a good chance that the patient will develop some conflict and not be able to keep it. There's also a chance the doctor will develop a conflict and not be able to keep it. And then you're rescheduling all these folks. And sometimes people will tell you that they can't get there, and sometimes they won't. And the idea now that a lot of practices have moved to is basically same-day scheduling and saying there's only a certain number of people we're going to see in a day and call that day. And there's a lot of literature behind it. There's queuing theory behind it, the Institute for Healthcare Improvement demonstrated that this worked. And we did this in our practice, and it was something that the patients loved, and we did a whole lot less wasted work of canceling and rescheduling and canceling and rescheduling once we moved to such a system.
So advice to patients would be, if they're listening to this?
Advice to patients would be look around in your community for a practice that's offering
the open access.
Open access scheduling, mm-hmm. Yes. There are plenty here in Philadelphia, including my former practice.
Okay. Baby boomers are on the cusp of old age. Well, we all know the older age, old age. How exactly is this going to stress the healthcare system?
Oh, my goodness. I mean, these are folks with multiple health-related conditions on multiple medications, seeing multiple providers. So they're seeing a lung doctor to help them with their lung disease and an oncologist to help manage their cancer and a GI doctor for something.
And where's the primary doctor?
And the primary doctor is desperately trying to catch up with all the information that's flying around and interpret it for the patient.
All right. We'll pick up on that in just a moment. Richard Barron is president and CEO of the American Board of Internal Medicine. Anne O'Sullivan, professor of primary care nursing at the University of Pennsylvania School of Nursing. Julie Robner is senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moskowane. Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. Back in just a moment.
The Barnes Foundation supports WHYY. The World is an Apple. The Still Lifes of Paul Cézanne is in its final weeks. Along with the 69 Cézannes in the permanent collection, this exhibition shows how Cézanne revolutionized the still life genre, making fruits, flowers, and skulls vibrate with color and pulse with life, and demonstrates why he was hailed as the father of modern art, now through September 22nd. Tickets available daily on-site or at barnesfoundation.org or 215-278-7200.
The elevator punch can't be the end of the Ray and Janae Rice story.
Janae will not realize her situation until she's actually removed herself from it.
An abused spouse takes us into the scary closed world of a football marriage coming apart and the NFL not in the huddle. Next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
today at noon on WHYY.
Penn Medicine's Heart and Vascular Center joins you in supporting WHYY. With over 20 community cardiology practices throughout Pennsylvania and New Jersey, Penn's Heart and Vascular Center is committed to delivering advanced treatment options, personalized care, and convenient access close to home. Learn more about Penn's Heart and Vascular Center at pennheart.org or 800-789-PENN. Penn Medicine's Heart and Vascular Center. Your life is worth Penn Medicine.
I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, and today for Marty Moscowane. The subject this hour is primary care in this country. As patient demand grows and relatively few med students are choosing to become general practitioners, are we heading toward a crisis point? Our guests this hour are Richard Barron, President and CEO of the American Board of Internal Medicine. Ann O'Sullivan is Professor of Primary Care Nursing at the University of Pennsylvania School of Nursing. And Julie Rovner is Senior Correspondent for Kaiser Health News. We've gotten a lot of calls, but we still have some lines open. 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email at radiotimes@whyy.org or tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. And we've gotten an email from Jesse in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. What do your panelists think about board certification of naturopathic doctors? Richard?
Well, I guess that would be my question as the CEO of a board. I think that boards exist where there are bodies of scientific knowledge and disciplines of practice that have boundaries, where there's evidence to support the effort that that the clinicians undertake, and that we've moved in the last 100 years to science-based practice. And at least the people in traditional allopathic and osteopathic medical schools have not found a deep scientific basis for naturopathic practice. It's got deep roots. People have been using it a long time. There are plenty of patients out there doing it, but it doesn't fit in the same scientific framework, and I don't think that we're going to see board certification of naturopathic physicians.
Let's talk about young people in medical school who come out with a lot of debt. I think the average, according to the American Medical Colleges, the Association of American Medical Colleges back in 2012, was $170,000. A disincentive, obviously, if you're thinking of primary care, you're just not going to make as much as the specialist is going to make. There are some programs which, and I think you alluded to this earlier, Anne, that are offering financial incentives, such as loan forgiveness. If you move out to a rural area, that might make it easier for you to get on your feet. What else is out there to help the primary, the med students say, okay, I'll choose primary care?
I think one of the things that Richard mentioned earlier with that baby boomer who had all those specialties, if they had been part of a medical care home or a nurse-led clinic, they would have had someone coordinating all of that care. So they might not have gone to quite as many specialists, and I think it might have been better connected. So I think that's one thing that when a medical student is a physician in a health care home or sometimes called medical care home, they see a team and they take turns doing for the patient what needs to be done at that particular visit. And I think that makes you feel better about your practice. And I think feeling good about the practice is as important as anything else with regards to this. I think that's why nurse practitioners stay in their primary care practice, because we really love it. You know, you go to work liking what you do, and when the skills and challenges are very similar, you're in flow, they talk about, and how exciting you are then. You know, it's like doing your favorite dance or reading the best book in the world. You feel flow at work, and that's what we want to have people feeling satisfied at work. And when you feel satisfied, you're more apt to stay there. So I think that's a big piece that we want to be sure. Maybe more interaction with nurse education and medical education together, so we are not, you know, bucking each other, but in fact being good team players with each other would be fabulous. You know, my colleagues for 35 years in pediatrics have been spectacular. I've never had any physician, you know, nurse practitioner negative phenomena. And I think the same is true with regards to internists and gerontologists especially.
I completely agree with Anne that our goal should be flow, and team-based care and interdisciplinary education is, it could be a big part of that. The question you were asking, Mary, was about the financing. Mm-hmm. And I'd make a couple of observations. You know, medical students face the challenging situation of It's like people trying to make investment decisions, and they warn you even on the TV commercials, past performance is not predictive of future performance. So as we look back over the last 20 years at what the incomes have been available to different forms of medical practice, I think it's pretty clear that the incomes available are going to be very different over the next 20 years. Primary care has little economic value to the healthcare delivery system when what's incentivized are all these fancy procedures. And when the fancy procedures are revenue-generating things, the major value that primary care has, economically speaking, is referring patients to institutions for those procedures. And it's one of the reasons why Ed was able to find a primary care doctor connected with a hospital who might operate a practice in hopes that that practice will refer in. But still, for the health system, they're getting a lot more revenue out of those fancy procedures than they are out of the primary care. But some of the new models of care that the Affordable Care Act is driving are more what are referred to as global payment models. And then primary care, as Anne was saying earlier, if you're coordinating care and reducing the number of unnecessary procedures that are being done, reducing the number of inappropriate consultations that are being done, paying more attention to patients proactively, then you're actually generating a lot of economic value because people paid in a global payment system want to do fewer procedures and want to try to keep their patients healthy. So I think the new payment models may make the economic future for primary care a lot brighter.
Okay, but before we get back to the phones, Julie Rovner, where is the ACA on implementation of those global payment models?
Testing them. It's slow. I think one thing that we didn't mention, about debt was there is an effort. I'm actually spending my fellowship sort of looking at medical education and training the workforce. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of effort rather than trying to get people who, were raised and trained in big cities to go to rural areas, to get people from those rural areas trained. They're more likely to go back. That's their home. And there are increasing numbers of programs that are helping pay the tuitions of those people because many of them come from, not particularly wealthy backgrounds, and it's hard to fund their medical education, but to actually help pay for their medical education, and then they do come back, and then they do stay because that's where their family is.
Sure. I understand that there's one institution in Texas that's actually gone to the 3-year med school model or is thinking of it. And these young people who would be graduating from that particular 3-year model would go right into family practice.
There are several, actually, that are doing that.
And the question, of course, that immediately comes to mind is 3 years enough? Because primary care is a practice that involves everything. You have to know a little bit about everything.
I don't think we have an evidence-based answer to that question, as so often is the case in educational situations. I completely agree that primary care clinicians need to be broadly trained. They really need to be broadly and deeply trained. I think the idea that somehow it's a simple thing that anybody can do and that the really hard work is on the specialty side is a complete misunderstanding of the challenges facing people in primary care and a disservice to patients that who are served by primary care clinicians. I think you need broad training. Whether 3 years is enough, I look forward to the results of that experiment.
Actually, a lot of those 3-year programs are more than 3 years because you end up going during the summer. So I think most of them are, really just a couple of months shy of what their 4-year colleagues are getting.
Right. All right. To the phones we go. Rob in Newark, Delaware. Welcome to Radio Times.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. My name is Rob. I'm a family physician. And I want to first thank Dr. Barron for his really eloquent explanation of what seems to be my entire experience. I graduated from medical school 12 years ago, and I went to residency for 3 years after that. And I went to work in an underserved rural area. And I left that about a year ago and came. I went to New Zealand for a year where I practiced medicine. And I'm now coming back to the States, and I'm going to be working in an urban underserved area. And when I speak to my colleagues who are specialists who are kind of bemoaning the implementation of the Affordable Care Act, what I hear largely is complaints about the the decrease in their income, the potential decrease in their income. And I find it somewhat disturbing that people that make two or three times more income than me are going to be making only twice as much money as I am. And I find that overwhelmingly the experience I'm having is that when people complain about the Affordable Care Act from a medical standpoint as physicians, they're complaining about the loss of income and not whether or not it's actually beneficial that 30-something-odd million other people are being are now going to have access to health care.
It sounds like you really love primary care.
I love what I do. I think it's a fantastic job. I went to it a little bit later in life, though, which is that I didn't start medical school till I was 30, and I had a different expectation of what physician salaries were going to be, which is that I feel that some of my colleagues who are 20 and 30 years older expected a certain level of income that, you know, they would get a certain amount of work. And now that they're not getting that, they feel very disenchanted with their medical careers, especially in primary care.
Rob?
And I guess the question is, are physician salaries actually coming into line with what they should be? I mean, were we paying doctors too much for too long? And don't get me wrong, as a family physician, I think I get a fine salary, though it is one-third of what some specialists make. It's still not like I'm a school teacher with 40 kids making $45,000 a year.
Sure,
we get
good
paid
question.
A fine amount of money.
Thanks so much for calling Radio Times, Rob. So, physician salary, are they coming into line with?
Well, they're clearly changing, and they're changing under the kinds of economic forces that we were talking about earlier. That as you move toward global payment and you move toward the phrase that the federal government uses these days, is we're moving from volume to value, and I think that all of us would welcome that as a move in healthcare. It's very challenging to talk about salaries in anything, whether it's sports figures, whether it's investment bankers, whether it's lawyers, whether it's doctors. I think most people look at their salary, develop some sense of what they ought to be getting by looking around. And it's exactly as Rob said, that you're comparing yourself to people who kind of look like they're doing what you're doing, but they're making a lot more. Or you're comparing this year to last year and the year before, and managing that kind of change is hard. I think Dickens had some line about show me a man who's, you know, earning £2 a week and living happily under that in a budget, I'll show you a happy man. Show me somebody earning £2,000 and living on £2,500, I'll show you an unhappy man. So it's challenging, and I don't think there's any absolute right answer to that.
All right, back to the phones. Maggie from Pennsburg, Pennsylvania. Hello, you're on Radio Times.
Hi, I'm the wife of a former family practice physician who practiced in Pennsylvania in both rural areas, underserved areas, and then in more suburban Montgomery County. And I have to say, after seeing my husband through college and medical school and residency, because I've been with him for the long haul, it's so unfortunate that although he loved his patients and his practice, he considers family practice medicine as a choice of a career. It's the worst choice he ever made in his life.
Oh, boy.
Because it just buried an economic hole in our lives that we have yet to dig out of. We have had 3 calls from Sally Mae this morning owing still over $100,000. And I have a 17-year-old going off to college next year. And of course, so, when I apply for, yeah, it's just, and so he recently left and is now living in Maryland doing a specialty.
So, Maggie, I'm reading on the screen here. He recently left for lack of reimbursements, the 70 hours he worked a week. Talk about the reimbursements, if you would.
Sure. I think the problem is that, especially southeastern Pennsylvania, and any medical recruiter will tell you this, it's one of the worst places in the country to practice medicine because there's such a stranglehold from the insurance companies in terms of reimbursement. It's kind of like I always say, being the liberal that I am, I wish that we had unions for doctors, because if a big corporation an insurance company says, okay, we're going to pay you less for this procedure, there's very little you can do. You can't drop 1,000 people from your patient roles and expect to stay in practice. You just have to eat it. So my husband was doing more and more moonlighting and less, you know, less and less income, regardless of whether, you know, his performance was great, and it was.
Okay.
Trust me, there were lots of people who cried when he left his practice. But I think, you know, Josh Shapiro, a few years ago, our Montgomery County Commissioner, formerly in another role in the state, had worked on some, you know, payback plans for service in family practice. And I think that globally in the United States, we need to look at reimbursement for it being like a service-oriented profession. And it's not just a third that family and other primary care physicians are making. Sometimes it's a tenth of what other physicians are making.
Right.
And that's just
Maggie, I'm going to have to stop you there because we're up against the clock, but a lot of good points. Richard?
I completely agree with Maggie that we need to make it possible for people to thrive practicing primary care in the country. And I think the thing that makes me hopeful about that is the recognition increasingly by policy people, by the federal government, and actually, Maggie, I'll tell you, I think by payers, they're trying to figure out how to invest more in primary care, but they need to see a model that uses teams, that is efficient in the way that it manages patients, and that manages things that are not just at visits. We don't have such a model, and it's difficult for primary care doctors in practice to build one because there's no economic support. So we're kind of in a catch-22. We need a clinical model we don't have. We need a payment system we don't have. And we need to invent both of them at the same time. The federal government's taking steps to create new payment models, as are some insurers. Primary care and education settings are taking steps to create new practice models. We can't do it fast enough with 10,000 baby boomers coming online every day.
Do you see? Oh, go ahead.
But I think, sadly enough, you know, we thought there for a while that primary care was going to get better reimbursement, and for 2 or 3 years we did, and then it gets dropped back again. So I think it's not consistent. The federal government doesn't sustain us consistently with regards to the reimbursement, and so I think even though we're trying these pilots, it's hard to feel very hopeful that it will ultimately be implemented based on the past.
I was lucky enough to work in the federal government on developing some of the pilots, and I think when they show results, the federal government will invest in them heavily, and I think they're in the process of doing that now.
Okay, and I'd like to bring Julie Rovner in for some final thoughts. You've got about 15 seconds, Julie.
Yeah, one of the things we haven't talked about is the lifestyle issues, and one of the things I think that needs to happen in primary care is that there needs to be an effort to make it as attractive from a lifestyle point of view as some of the special are with, you know, regular hours and that kinds of stress.
Yes. Okay. Thank you so much. That wraps it up for this hour of Radio Times. Julie Rovner, senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Great to have you.
Thank you.
Ann O'Sullivan, professor of primary care nursing at the University of Pennsylvania School of Nursing. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Richard Barron, president and CEO of the American Board of Internal Medicine. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. Me too, Mary.
For more on Radio Times, visit our Facebook page. And you can also find our podcasts by heading to our homepage, whyy.org/Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moskowain. Thanks for joining us. Hour 2 is just ahead.